Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today we're talking to William Vollman. It's the second week we're spending on his new novel, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War. And last week we talked about some of the ideas and the history behind the book, but now I want to hear how the book sounds. So the first thing we're going to do is to ask Bill Vollman to give us a little bit of context and to read a section from the early part of the book.
Well, thanks for having me back, Michael. This is a little section near the beginning of the book. The Nez Perce have just been informed that they have to go on the reservation. They're going to be impoverished, maybe starved, and some of the young men just can't take it. And so they rise up and commence the war with some atrocities. Chief Joseph, whose real name is Hainmat Tuyalakekt, has just heard about this. He's come back home into his teepee and trying to figure out what to do. And the name of his antagonist is General Howard, whom he calls Cut Arm. In the darkness, he remembers Cut Arm's hair, the color of a mudfish, and the Bostons talking like dogs lapping up water, sitting high while we must seat ourselves on the ground before them, Cut Arm murmuring with moss beard, the blue coat showing the rifle always, and those Bostons from Mount Idaho, which we used to call Rawhide Place, and from Chinook Salmon Water, all watching us with triumphant hatred as the baby begins to cry, springtime sleepily lifting her out of the cradle board, which has not yet been decorated, and White Thunder snoring uneasily by the doorway through which the breeze comes, smelling of lake and horses, far away coyotes singing, the baby suckling loudly, sound of running feet sleeping on her side, the moon shining silver in the smoke hole. Hainmat Tuyalakekt begins to sleep, wondering into which dark place his dreams will pull him, sick in his heart, which will not stop crying, quo, 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 asking himself why sound of running feet no longer asks him anything, turning his heart to wondering whether anything can be undone, even now that our worst young men have decided for us what we shall do. I must show anger to no one, not even them, since I saved myself from doing so to the worst of Bostons. Stretching out his legs, then unwrapping the blanket from his shoulders, now we have set ourselves against them, against their rifles and bugles and the staring eyes of the bluecoats. Whenever Cut Arm opens and closes his mouth, I am telling you three times, and Cut Arm showing the rifle while the Boston's women sing tum like Katie Dids. Now from the lake comes the cry of a marten, pak, pak, so that he remembers Wallowa Lake, beginning to swim out into the crystalline heart of its dreaminess, and then, pim, pim, a bullet passes through the lodge, zzz, and White Thunder leaps up, shouting, people, enemies are shooting in here, as the baby begins to scream. His blood is on fire. Longing to kill these Bostons, he comforts his women while his brave nephew runs out with his rifle. Pim! And the Bostons gallop away, their horses crying, Hini me.
William Fulman, reading one of the beginning sections from The Dying Grass. Now, this book opens itself slowly. That sound, pim pim, which is used as the sound of bullets, is also for them the sound of the drum. And that's where many natural sounds, the sounds that the horses make, the sounds of mosquitoes, they're ritualized. And so they're not onomatopoeia exactly. They're the sound of the sound of a sound.
That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, one of the luckiest helps that I had in writing this book was to find the Nez Perce English Dictionary by a linguist named Aoki. It's actually longer than The Dying Grass. And I read it from cover to cover and just took note of several words on every page. And I began to get some sense often of the culture as well as the sounds. There's one word, for instance, the words are often like sentences. And this word simply translates as, she is gathering grass for bedding. Mm. And I thought, okay, so then we know the women are the ones who gather grass for bedding. And on this long flight of the Nez Perce, we have to have the female characters doing this. And then there are all these sounds like pim and schlock and so forth.
That's the sound the babies make.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, the book opens, from what I saw in retrospect, with a comparison between the language of Rutherford B. Hayes, who is being inaugurated, and the language of Walt Whitman, who is remembering his time among the dying soldiers of the Civil War. And we're hearing right away the no-nonsense language that makes distinctions, that makes divisions between things, and the language of Whitman, which puts everything together, which in turn gives way in the book to the language of the soldiers and their commanders, a hierarchy language, and the language we just heard of the Indians. How would you describe that language?
Well, it was very, very difficult to really know how the Indians should sound. But, you know, the few primary sources on the Nez Perce War were collected by a really wonderful man named L.V. McWhorter, who befriended some Nez Perce and tried to defend them when he could. And eventually they would tell him stories about the war. He would write them down. English was not their first language, so they were written in a kind of pidgin. Of course, the Nez Perce are not going to speak to each other in pidgin. And so I would start with some of the things that they said in this pidgin, and then use Aoki's dictionary to try to make them sound, you know, like the kind of thing adults would say instead of children, and then to make them more stately.
Is there any available recording of the language at all?
There are some Nez Perce songs on a couple of CDs that I got at the reservation in Lapwai. And the language itself is spoken by very, very few people now.
How many Nez Perce exist or are left now?
It's hard to say because some of them intermarried with other tribes, and some of them left the reservation. So it's a very vexed question, you know, who is an Indian? So, you know, let's say, you know, a very few thousand.
And of those very few thousands, how many do you think still know the ancestral language?
With any fluency, I'm going to guess, 5%.
Wow.
I'm sure that there are many who know many of the words. But that, in a way, you know, was what the United States wanted, taking the Indians and putting them in boarding schools where their languages would be forbidden.
Where they were punished for speaking.
That's right. And they thought that that was really the kindest thing to do, to make them into American.
I'm talking to William Vollman about his new book, The Dying Grass. Now, tell me, there seems to be, again, a dichotomy. The men in the army are treated like children being punished, and they're punished by a father figure. The Indians are largely dealing with a mother figure, Mother Earth. Yeah. And it leads us to a whole different sense of language. Orders are essentially paternal, and this constant, I will punish you if I catch you drinking, says the general. I will punish you if I catch you using profanity. It seems as if in hierarchy there are chiefs among the Nez Perce, but there are also dreamers. Who are the dreamers, and how does one become a dreamer?
The dreamer religion is what ultimately gave rise to the ghost dance that was put down so cruelly at Wounded Knee. And one of the founding dreamer prophets was a man named Smohalla, or Smohali, as the whites called him. His ancestral birthplace is now dammed underwater, and then the area around it is contaminated with plutonium. But they had an idea that if you prayed and respected the first fruits of the earth, that somehow, this sounds trite, but that sort of kept the balance, you know? And there was a more militant offshoot of the dreamer religion that led to the ghost dance that, you know, it asserted that if these rituals were carried out, the whites would die, the buffalo would come back, and the Indians would come back and get their land again. So it was a pretty desperate kind of dream. When General Howard uses the word dreamer, he doesn't really understand it. To him, dreamer just means pagan. But it was a specific polytheistic religion.
Now, The Dying Grass is the fifth book of a series called Seven Dreams. Is that title influenced? Are you aspiring to be a dreamer?
Well, I do my best. I wish I could dream about the future, but it seems as if I only dream about the past.
Uh-huh. Now tell me, when you began the series with the ice shirt, what did you know about the dreamer religion?
Nothing. All I knew about the seven dreams really was that they were going to deal with loss and transformation on our continent. And the very first of those dreams begins with the Norse prehistory, in which men could change into bears and back again. That prehistory gradually elaborated itself into real kings and sons of kings. And I mean, that's how it always is with our past, you know, the things that we hear about things that happened before we were alive. They're mythic things that we can never fully imagine and believe. But we have some feeling, oh, it must have been very other, very eerie. And that's the feeling I have, you know, when I go back into these different time periods.
The extraordinary lineation of dying grass, these are laid out on the page the way poetry is laid out, the way Ezra Pound's cantos are laid out, and they seem to be an attempt, very difficult to achieve, that writers have always made to be able to render the internal, things unspoken, things only thought or dreamed, at the same time as you render the external, what's seen, what the scenery is like, and the reader is meant to take it in all at once, the kind of attention that it demands asks you to travel into the scene as written. And I really would leave reading this book to return to a different world and a different mode of perception.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say that. It was a bit of a struggle, you know, to figure out how to arrange the words on the page. But I guess my founding inspiration was that Peter Matheson book, Far Tortuga.
Oh, I love that book.
I love it, too. And
I didn't think of that. Uh-huh.
That book has far more white space on the page, and in a way it's more cinematic than this book. But it gave me an idea, you know, that you could use words to look a certain way. And if you read this book aloud, not, you know, too much, but some will be lost. You have to be able to see, okay, now here this indents to this and this indents to that. So you realize this person is saying this and thinking that, and then this happens.
Yes, what happens, for instance, is that the Indian fear that there will be nothing left segues into left, left, left my wife and 48 kids, the march of the cavalry, and that we're letting the language do the job of joining the two different worlds.
Yeah, there are so many different ways to do that, and hopefully I can find other formulas for other books. Recently, I had a chance to hear just a little bit of Faulkner reading from Light in August, and hearing him read it was kind of a revelation because it sounded nothing like the way it looks on the page. You know, his books are so dense, and the way he was reading very slowly and carefully, it had the illusion of ordinary speech, even though it was very, very fluent, you know, and it was perfect. And I thought it would be sort of nice to be able to do something like that. You get one effect from reading it with your eyes and another effect from reading it, you know, with your vocal cords.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with William T. Volman. What does the T stand for?
Tanner.
Okay. About his book, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with William Volman about his recent book, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, the latest in the series Seven Dreams, Book of North American Landscapes. Now, tell me, how do you choose the stories that you're going to tell, do you regard them as mythic or paradigms for life? Now, as I read The Dying Grass, I felt I was reading an allegory of what's happening to America in its involvement in Afghanistan. Are these stories exemplary in that way?
Well, the stories were always paradigms. They were used or misused by others. So, you know, we have this idea about the romance between Pocahontas and Captain John Smith. And we know Chief Joseph, I will fight no more forever. So let's start with those, you know, and see what really happened or what I think happened. And then, of course, since they're part of our consciousness, our American consciousness, they become other sorts of paradigms. And as I was working on this, it wasn't my conscious intention to draw parallels with Iraq and so forth. But after a while, you can't help but think, well, are we in the same sort of mechanical devouring process that we were in back then? This whole idea of fear-mongering and seizing whatever it is that we want and then disguising it as something else. You know, the Indian wars were all power grabs disguised as race wars. So, you know, the Iraq war presumably is a power grab, you know, disguised as self-defense from Al-Qaeda.
Well, as I read, I found many aspects of the book opening themselves to themes that I know are central to you. For instance, among the Nez Perce tribe, there's a man-woman, and she made me think about Dolores, the woman that you photograph yourself as, and the punishment, essentially, the extent to which she'll go to be able to dress as a woman, and then, given her presence, the way the Indians use war paint. It's an extension of makeup.
That's true. And yeah, doing the Dolores stuff was actually great preparation for, you know, trying to eliminate that Welwayus character.
She becomes a fascinating character in this examination of what is a wife, what is a mother, what is a true marriage, when does it end, what is a squaw, how are they used by the white people, how are they used by the Indian men who marry several of them at once. How long does one of these books take to germinate and then to write?
This took about 12 to 15 years, I would say.
And the one that you're working on now, the next one, how long have you been working on it so far?
I started it in 1985 and put a lot of work into it in 1986. And I've looked at it very little since then. So when I pick it up, it'll be unfamiliar and I'll have some ideas that'll just leap out at me.
When are you not writing, or rather, are you ever not writing?
I'm always, you know, my mind is always working. So I guess I would say, yeah, I'm writing, in a way, all my waking moments and some of my sleeping ones.
Do you think that to be a writer, it's virtually, I mean, a great writer, a writer who's likely to be remembered by whatever culture remains to remember. Do you think it's necessary that that level of devotion is a necessity?
I don't know. Speaking only for myself, you know, I would say that that's what makes me fulfilled, and that if I feel like I haven't done a good enough job, then I want to keep working and working and as long as it takes, as many pages as it takes, I don't care. I would just be so disappointed in myself if I didn't do that. And there are some of my books, you know, when I look back on them, that I consider weak. I wish I could have done a better job at the time, but I didn't know how. So I cut myself some slack for that.
By the end of The Dying Grass, it's not just the grass that has died. It's a way of life that's dependent on the grass to make mattresses, to provide roots. And we're with these characters as they outlast the world that created them. And the sadness is so beautiful because, you know, America has a current obsession with zombies. And yet, by the end of this book, the characters we know are experiencing a living death.
That is true. And I wonder if, I hope it's not the case, if we will, as a result of global warming, go through some kind of a similar process, maybe in our own lifetimes, of outliving so much of what was beautiful and special to us.
I've been talking with William Vollman, the author of The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War. It's the fifth of the Seven Dreams series. I'll give you the titles. The Ice Shirt, The Rifles, Fathers and Crows, Argyll, and now The Dying Grass, the Seven Dreams series. It's published by Viking, all of it, and they've done a noble job in doing such an impressively ambitious series of novels. Thank you, William T. Vollman, for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael. I'm always happy when I get to visit you again.
I'm always happy to see you. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Dodi Bellamy is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.